That's Segundo here, and I wish to point out that it is entirely impossible for me to contemplate the impossible. I once spent 3 years dreaming the impossible dream, only to be told by an attorney that there were installments in some payment plan, and that I would go to jail if I didn't oblige. So while I admire Dr. Michio Kaku's spirit, he's obviously much smarter than I am, and our young roving correspondent just barely kept up. I wonder if he's ever understood that reconciling with your ex-wife, even for an afternoon quickie, is a class one impossibility.
Okay, so I am here with Dr. Kaku, who is most recently the author of Theories of the Impossible. Dr. Kaku, how are you doing?
Very good.
First off, I wanted to ask you about one of the real fascinating aspects of this book. So much of the science fiction concepts that you outlined in this, then you explicate with what is available in science, what might be available in science, particularly when it comes to parallel universes and quantum theory, a lot of it is predicated upon theory. And I found this to be interesting, and I wanted to ask you if there was possibly a kind of maximum cap on how much theory you can bandy about in the realm of physics, because you also have in the afterword, you basically sort of suggest that string theory is criticized because it's not good for physics, it's considered a fad. Maybe you can elaborate on this.
Well, in Physics of the Impossible, I wanted the most authoritative look at the fantastic devices of science fiction: ray guns, force fields, telepathy, psychokinesis, starships, time travel, interdimensional travel. And to do this, you have to use the two main foundations of modern physics: quantum theory, the theory of atomic physics, and relativity, the theory of black holes and Big Bangs. We have seen no deviation, I repeat, no deviation from either theory. That's the foundation of the book. Because, you know, when I was a child, I used to read a lot of science fiction, watch Flash Gordon and stuff. But after a while, you're left hungry for an explanation. Are those things you see in the movies really possible, or is it just a bunch of baloney? So I said to myself, well, I got to become a physicist. I got to become a physicist so that I'll be able to answer a lot of these questions. And that's why I wrote the book.
Yeah. But I'm wondering, though, because so much of it is theory and theory and theory, I mean, is there too much theory possibly in explaining some of this stuff?
Well, you see, unlike English literary criticism, which every year gets more and more elaborate, you know, what did Hemingway really mean? What did Joyce really mean by that? Physics is the opposite. Physics gets simpler and simpler and simpler every year. You realize I can write down all the fundamental laws of physics, everything, on one sheet of paper. One sheet of paper. So we're not talking about theory after theory after theory. We're only talking about a page. And what I do for a living is string theory, and we want to get that page down to 1 inch. That's my goal in life.
1 inch. Well, this is the great theory of everything that people are constantly looking for. I'm wondering if there's a sort of scenario in which everything could be too simple, this one-page cheat sheet sort of thing.
No. For example, light can be summarized by Maxwell's equations. It's a very simple equation. It says the four-dimensional divergence of an antisymmetric second-rank tensor equals zero. And in Berkeley, where I got my PhD, you can buy a T-shirt which says, "In the beginning, God said, the four-dimensional divergence of an antisymmetric second-rank tensor is zero, and there was light. And it was good." And that's absolutely correct. All of light can be summarized in an equation about an inch long.
Well, I wanted to also ask you about one aspect of this book that I wanted to kind of get some elucidation on, and that was the notion of decoherence and the wave function of the universe. I was really fascinated by all this, the idea that we can be living in this universe and actually we are tuned into the wave frequency of our particular universe, and there are many other ones. But you also point out to Hawking's idea that we exist in the universe with the largest probability. And it's also true that the amount of positive and negative aspects of our world equals zero. And so I'm wondering how we can test this earlier theory and how it relates to this notion of everything equaling to zero.
Well, first of all, everything is vibrating. We know that from quantum mechanics. We know that from atomic physics. That's why we have laser beams, the internet, iPods, television, flat screens, everything is a function of the fact that things are vibrating. if things are vibrating out of frequency too much, they are no longer in phase. And in fact, entire universes can be out of phase. So in your living room, believe it or not, there are the wave function of universes which are no longer vibrating in phase with you. Universes of dinosaurs, universes of aliens, pirates, universes where the Earth blew apart, all in your living room, but we're no longer in tune with them. Therefore, they are parallel universes that we cannot enter, and we study them because we're physicists, but they don't give us tangible experimental results because we cannot enter these other universes.
Yeah.
But we think they're there.
We think they're there, but it's not entirely testable, these parallel universes. And I'm
wondering, yes.
This is why it goes back to my original idea about theory and whether there can possibly be a
summer, in fact, in May, the largest atom smasher, the largest machine of science ever built by Homo sapiens, will be turned on. It is the Large Hadron Collider, and it's going to be 27 kilometers in circumference, and we hope to test some of these theories.
So we're going to be testing a lot of these theories, essentially, and then finally the physicists will duke it out, or will be shamed, or will be lauded based off of this. I mean, it can't test all of them, can it?
No, but we hope to detect what are called sparticles, mini black holes, which are predicted by string theory, and we hope to then create them in the laboratory, including dark matter, for example. All the things that are quite exotic but are predicted by string theory, we hope to test with the Large Hadron Collider to be turned on in May of this year.
You point out in this book that the Alcubierre drive was probably the first time that a TV show helped to inspire a solution to one of Einstein's equations. But science fiction isn't always compatible with physics. I mean, in your chapter on perpetual motion machines, you point out that the Financial Times, The Economist, and The Wall Street Journal have all run lengthy features on perpetual motion machines. So there's certainly great inspiration to be found in science fiction. And yet these reporters don't seem to be aware of the second law of thermodynamics. And so I'm wondering if it's equally a problem for physics people to get the word out, to at least get the record straight, if there's articles along these lines that continue to suggest that there are perpetual motion machines when it runs counter to these rules.
I get a lot of phone calls from Wall Street Journal journalists who call me on the phone, and they say that some inventor is making millions of dollars getting investors to invest in their perpetual motion machine, not just one, but a whole slew of them, and they're millionaires now.
Yeah. Tulip mania, it sounds like.
And so I tell the Wall Street Journal, I quote from P.T. Barnum, who once said, quote, "There's a sucker born every minute." These people are very smart, making money, but they know nothing about science, which is really a shame, because unless you know science, you can lose your shirt.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm wondering, though, I mean, where does science fiction play into this? If some people are losing their shirts and some people are actually profiting with knowledge, like the Alcubierre drive, for example, then is science fiction good, bad, or is it just one of those neutral constructs in our world in which people can be exploited or actually be inspired by?
Well, science fiction, I think, plays several roles. First of all, it inspires scientists. Jules Verne's works inspired Edwin Hubble to become an astronomer, the greatest astronomer of the 20th century, rather than a lawyer. He was in law school when he switched and decided to become an astronomer because he remembered the thrill as a child of reading Jules Verne. Also, Carl Sagan read Edgar Rice Burroughs' John Carter of Mars series and dreamed about roaming on the surface of Mars. That's why Carl Sagan became an astronomer. And second of all, there's a lot of cross-pollination between the two. Many people think that antimatter was invented by Gene Roddenberry of Star Trek fame. Wrong. Antimatter comes from physics. 1928, the work of Paul Dirac. He predicted the existence of antimatter. Second of all, when you look at warp drive has its origins in the warps of Albert Einstein. So Gene Roddenberry copied Einstein. But then Alcubierre was watching Star Trek one day and said, let's take this seriously, a warp drive just like the Enterprise. He put that into Einstein's equations, and out popped out the Alcubierre drive.
Yeah.
So here was a question of physics, fertilizing Roddenberry, fertilizing physics.
But most people opt to believe in the Roddenberry over the Alcubierre. That's the question, you know?
Yeah, but when we physicists, though, we're the ones who build these things, right? When we have to look at these equations, we realize that Roddenberry was a fiction writer. Also, I mentioned in the book that H.G. Wells predicted the atomic bomb. He predicted the year that a scientist would discover the secret of the atomic bomb. Leo Szilard read that book. I repeat, the man who discovered the chain reaction read H.G. Wells' book, saw himself as the man who discovered the secret of the atomic bomb, and got the secret just within, you know, a year or so of the prediction, and that led to the atomic bomb. So the atomic bomb was in some sense inspired by H.G. Wells.
You're rather giddy talking about the atomic bomb. I'm a little worried here.
When I was a kid, my mentor was Edward Teller.
Yeah.
He's the father of the hydrogen bomb, and he even offered me a job building hydrogen bombs.
And you declined that job?
I declined that job.
Why did you do that?
I'd rather work on something even bigger.
Even bigger?
The Big Bang.
Yeah. But I'm wondering if issues of destruction entered that decision.
Well, let's be blunt about it. The military does fund a lot of this research, like invisibility. We physicists, 2 years ago, made an object disappear under microwave radiation. Just a few months ago, as the book was going to press, physicists at Caltech and in Germany were able to show that light, red light and green light, can also bend in a way consistent with invisibility. Yes. I'd say in 10 years, we'll make the first object invisible under one color.
Yeah.
Within a few decades, all three primary colors. So, Harry Potter, watch out.
There's also, though, as you point out numerous times in the book, a kind of risk in prognosticating upon when something is going to be available. You allude to journalists asking you, or asking other scientists, when, say, invisibility is going to be, when are we going to have the flying car and the like? And I wanted to sort of ask you, this book offers the class one, the class two, and the class three and all that. And I'm wondering if perhaps there's the risk of some readers reading the book and possibly saying, we're going to have our flying cars tomorrow. Is this more of a speculative approach that you intend here? Or in terms of dwelling upon this idea of when something is going to be available, this seems to me to run counter to the kind of intuitive nature of science that just seems to run on its own drumbeat.
Yes and no. First of all, the predictions that we'll have flying cars, vacations on Venus, and robot maids and butlers, that was done in a cartoon called The Jetsons. And yet so many journalists accuse us, physicists, of making the predictions made in The Jetsons. We have no connection whatsoever to that cartoon series. We have our own set of predictions, but unfortunately, journalists usually don't come to us, because we physicists work in an ivory tower. That's one reason why I wrote the book, to set the record straight. We never predicted that we were going to vacation on Venus. I don't care what the Jetsons do. So this book, Physics of the Impossible, is authoritative. It looks at what really, really could happen in the coming decades.
So basically, you're setting yourself up as the middleman between the futurist fiction writers and the physics people, because someone needs to do it. Nobody else is willing to come forward and say, hey, you know, we do have a few pieces of science that we can help you with so that you can kind of make a more accurate prediction.
No, I'm not a go-between between futurists and physicists. Mm-hmm. I'm a go-between physicists and the public.
Okay.
Futurists themselves usually just blabber on without any sense of science. I'm a scientist.
Yeah.
So I'm a go-between between the scientific community and the public.
I actually wanted to ask you in relation, and this goes back to my earlier query about theory and also the idea of science fiction possibly being a pernicious influence upon science, and that is you observe that the slingshot effect that we see, of course, in Star Trek IV, well, that really can only be tested based off of Freeman Dyson's theory that involves two neuron stars that are revolving. You also observe that Dan Brown's Angels and Demons is even more preposterous in the way that it depicts an antimatter bomb, which goes far beyond anything in the slingshot effect. So regular audiences, however, are lapping this kind of stuff up, and so I'm wondering how you can possibly address these things in a very reasonable manner and get the general public sort of talking about this, because, I mean, these, you know, an antimatter bomb, that's pretty preposterous if you ask me.
Well, you're right, but the public, almost 100% of what the public sees and reads about concerning the future is done by amateurs, with no scientific background whatsoever. Dan Brown is not an authority on antimatter. He's an authority on the Da Vinci Code, which was a work of fiction, actually. But people take him as an authority on these things. So unfortunately, 100% of what the average person interacts with in terms of the future is nonsense. That's why I wrote the book, so that at least one book sets the record straight.
But I'm wondering, though, if fiction is so omnipresent in our culture, how this book can really sort of get there, how people can actually, how laymen can be get excited about Freeman Dyson, you know?
Well, it's difficult, but, you know, we physicists have to try, because otherwise the public will not support science. Let me give an example. The Large Hadron Collider, this atom smasher, gets turned on in May in Geneva. Why Geneva? Why not Dallas, Texas? Mm-hmm. Because the Congress canceled our machine in 1994. And they canceled it because we physicists were unable to convince the American public to fund basic research. And in the old days, we would go to Congress and say, Russia. And then Congress would say, how much? How much do you want? Yeah. We don't want the Russians to get this atom smasher. Well, everybody knows the Russians aren't building atom smashers anymore. Yeah. So why should the United States? So that's one reason why I wrote the book, Physics of the Impossible, to engage the public, to show them the excitement of science, real science, not just Jetson science, but real science, and inspire, hopefully, the next generation of scientists.
Well, going back to the book, I wanted to actually ask you about the phasers and Death Star chapter. I was a little troubled by this because you present very compelling reasons why the phasers can't be seen currently, and yet you avoid actually talking about the stun aspect of a phaser. And I wanted to ask you, because in 1999, there was a guy who came up with a ray gun, and he was basically trying to replicate that notion of the stun phaser. And I looked at your book, and you had a very reasonable premise that you needed these extraordinary power packs. And I'm wondering why, if you have particular scientific thoughts on the idea of a stun ray gun or a stun phaser.
Well, the reason why we don't have ray guns, as you mentioned, is that we don't have a portable power pack. We can build a laser beam that'll go right through a brick wall. That's today. You put a nuclear power plant behind a ray gun, you can blast right through a brick wall. The problem is you have to have a nuclear power plant. How do you miniaturize that? And at the present time, we don't know. As far as stun, we have sonic devices that will emit ultrasound and also microwave devices, several devices, in fact, that will make the skin feel very irritated and will scatter crowds. So for crowd control, that's being looked at. But the Death Star you mentioned earlier, that's something that a lot of people say was just impossible to build a Death Star. Well, actually, we have a Death Star in outer space right now. It's called WR-104. It's a star that's unstable, double star. It will undergo supernova, and it's pointed right at us. We are in the bullseye of WR-104, the crosshairs. And if that thing goes off, it could fry the planet Earth, just like in the movie Star Wars. So here's how you would do it. The Empire simply finds a dying star about to go supernova, spins it in a certain direction, aims it at Alderaan, and blows Alderaan to pieces. Yeah. That's how you do it.
But what of having a phaser with a stun and kill setting? That's why I sort of ask, or is this just really a very impractical physics application?
So far, we've found no way to use electromagnetic radiation to actually destabilize the nervous system of a person. We can make the skin uncomfortable. That's what we do with crowd control devices. But to stun the central nervous system, we haven't quite found the magic bullet for that yet.
Yeah. I'm wondering if there's if you were to hypothetically have a phaser with a stun in a kill setting, whether this power issue would affect having varying rays of deadliness, I suppose, if this would be a problem.
It depends on how much power you have. Like, for example, a lightsaber. Many people think that lightsabers are impossible. How can you solidify light? But the simplest way is to get a rod that shoots out of plasma. A plasma is a piece of the sun, a lightning bolt inside of a TV set. Hot gas comes out of the holes in a rod. And you can get a lightsaber that'll cut through steel. The problem is the power pack again. You need a small power pack. The only known portable power pack with that power is a miniature hydrogen bomb. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But that, of course, is self-destructive.
I also wanted to talk with you about the robots chapter in which you allude to Moore's Law. It's set to run out in 2020, unless scientists can come up with some alternative to silicon transistors. But this limitation, unfortunately, precludes the development of AI, neural networks, and the like. But I wanted to ask you, because you don't remark upon it in the book, are you aware of the Blue Brain Project in Switzerland? They managed to get 8,000 processors to replicate 10,000 neurons, and they allegedly are getting more neurons out of each processor. So I'm wondering if something along these lines might kind of actually work before 2020. I mean, do you have some thoughts on this?
8,000 processors would represent a lobotomized, stupid, retarded cockroach. Our human brain has 100 yeah. billion neurons. So 10,000 neurons would not be enough to propagate a flatworm. Now, you have to realize that by 2020, silicon power will finally be exhausted. We will end the age of silicon. Silicon Valley could become a rust belt. Last month, I was in Seattle. I spoke before 4,000 Microsoft engineers. I was the keynote speaker. These are the people designing your Windows computer of the future. And I mentioned this, and they said, we finally came around to it. Mm. We physicists have been telling them for years that 2020 is more or less a doomsday for silicon. And Microsoft is now saying, you guys were probably right. Yeah. They're now beginning to reconfigure their software. Instead of vertical processing, they're going into parallel processing now. Now, the point is, some people say that if Moore's Law keeps on going, we humans are going to be put in zoos. Our robot creations will throw peanuts at us, make us dance behind bars, because we'll be stupid compared to the super brains of our creations. Wrong. Because by 2020, computer power will flatten out. We don't know what the post-silicon era is going to look like. My friends work on it. Quantum computers, DNA computers, quantum dot computers, photonic computers, plasmonic computers. None of them are ready for prime time.
But I'm wondering if there's a way of compressing them, because this particular project in Switzerland was suggesting that they were going to squeeze more neurons into each particular processor. So it seems to me that if they can manage to get the number of neurons for the human brain, they might be able to do it. I don't know.
Even an insect has several million neurons to play with, and you realize that, 10,000 neurons.
So really it's quantum computers then.
It may have to be quantum computers. But again, the world's record for a quantum computing calculation is, get this, yeah. ta-da, 3 × 5 = 15.
Yeah. All that processing power. That's yeah. amazing.
Very
you
hard.
You get a slide ruler for that,
Yeah, 7 atoms. That was done on 7 atoms.
Yeah. Well, I also wanted to ask you, in the telepathy chapter, you dwell on functional MRIs. But I'm curious about this because, as you know, the polygraph has been pretty much dismissed by many scientists. There's a great book by Ken Alder, as a matter of fact, on the subject. And I know that the functional MRI has roughly around, depending upon whether you talk to the people who make the MRIs or scientists, 70 to 90% accuracy rate. So I'm wondering, if you don't have 100%, is this really science? Is this really kind of a way to get telepathy? Or is this something you just brought as a kind of development?
There are two ways to get telepathy. First is, if you have somebody who's paralyzed and cannot talk to the parents because totally paralyzed, you put a chip in their brain. And then you connect the chip to a laptop. And these people eventually learn how to play video games. They learn how to answer email and how to talk to their loved ones, even though they are functionally paralyzed. This is going to be the future of how we will deal with paralyzed people. Think of Stephen Hawking. He communicates with his eyeballs. The movement of his eyeballs is how he communicates with the world. Think of putting a chip in his brain, connecting it to a laptop. The second way is MRIs. Now, this is only 95% or so efficient, so they say. It takes more energy to make a lie than to tell the truth, and you could pick that up on a brain scan. Now, I say in my book that maybe the person is stressed, maybe the person is anxious, and therefore there's more brain activity when he tells the truth, okay? But the point was not that. The point that eventually we will have a dictionary of thought. This brain pattern on an MRI, this squiggle on an MRI, equals anxiety. This equals love. this equals lie. We'll have a one-to-one correspondence between these things. Now, will this dictionary be able to get it down to a word like the? Well, the word the probably circulates in a few thousand neurons, but one pixel, one dot on an MRI scan may correspond to a million neurons.
Yeah.
So unless we get the resolution up on MRI scans, we cannot pick up the word the inside a brain scan.
It's almost as if any kind of technology you can present for something like lying or something like brain imagery is bound to fail because of the brain is just far too complex
organ. The problem is the brain is not a computer.
Yeah.
Now, what do I mean by that? A computer is an adding machine or a Turing machine. Our brain is a neural network. It's a learning machine. Learning is distributed throughout the entire brain. So when you look at the word the, yeah, it's a few thousand neurons, but it's scattered over the brain. In a digital computer, it's concentrated in the Pentium chip. So that's why it's so difficult to use brain scans to analyze thinking, because thinking is spread out over the brain. But over the years, over the decades, I think we will get an encyclopedia or dictionary of thought.
Well, Dr. Kaku, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much. Thanks.
Thank you.